Hello, I'm Robin Lynn Maven, the CEO, creator, and producer of Vibes Live. We have over 2 million geographical listeners reaching 200 countries with nonstop music 24/7. Just tune in on VibesLive.com.
I say the hip hop, you just don't stop it, and just get ready to jam. The Disco Daddy Wide World of Hip Hop Radio Show, every Saturday at 1 p.m. Pacific Time, only on VibesLive.com, with special guests every week. Don't miss it.
Hello out there, Disco Daddy here, Disco Daddy's Wide World of Hip Hop. How's everybody doing today? This is our inaugural show, our first one, and it is a whopper, We've got giants on this show, people who have made a name for themselves in hip hop, legends. And as you all know, hip hop is the only genre, and we're lucky to have one of the movers and shakers of the movement with us today, Mr. Chris the Glove Taylor. How you doing, Chris?
I'm good, man. How you doing, sir?
I'm doing fine, man. Growing old gracefully. We'd like to start off with you on our show, telling us a little bit about you. You're known all over the world through your work with some giants. And I'm not going to name drop. I'm going to let you do that. Okay? But first, I'd like you to tell us a little bit about how you started and what made you become a DJ, what led you into the music field in the first place, a little bit about your background, where you're from, and what Chris the Glove Taylor is all about. Take it from
me. Right on, brother. Well, first of all, I want to say, man, it's an honor to be talking to you on the phone, man. We don't get very many conversations together. We always being moved around, you know.
But, yes, sir. Yes, sir. It's an honor for me, my brother.
Oh, yes, sir. But listen, so I'll tell you, the funny thing is, what really got me to want to be a DJ, I was on 96 in Western, man, at this little club, the workshop.
And the workshop, I remember that club.
A DJ, Disco Daddy.
Wow.
I never forget that.
Thank you. Thank you.
And I mean, it was the way it used to play all night bang, man, GQ. Or, whoa, Invisible Man's Band. Boom, 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 boom,
yes,
boom.
Sir.
Man, we used to go off on that one, brother. So, anyway, I was...
How old were you then?
16, sneaking in.
Okay, sorry to bring you out like that, but we want to keep everything in perspective. It was a teenage club.
Yes. Yeah, it was a teenage club, but you had to be 16. I was not quite 16. I graduated from high school at 16, so I was trying to do those things. I had moved to advancing grades, you know, and so I was hanging with older people at a younger age, so I couldn't get in a lot of places. But since I was tall, it made it seem like I
was. You were able to pull it off.
Yeah. So, I mean, okay. I grew up on over there on Western and 77th, and then when I moved over to Ladera Heights here, I tried to play basketball, got into that, and it turned out it wasn't really happening. I went to college for aeronautical engineering and decided one day walking down La Cienega, I wanted to be something that I felt that I could be the best in the world at, and it wasn't playing basketball. And there hadn't been a Michael Jordan yet either. No space shuttle and no Michael Jordan. I was trying to create the space shuttle, and I ended up with, you know, becoming a kind of on a space shuttle, man. So, you know, guys like you, I don't know if you remember Jammin' Gene. You remember Jammin' Gene?
No, I heard the name, but because I worked at a club every night, I wasn't able to go out.
I know the feeling, brother. I figured they was trying to come where you were. That's why I figured you might have known these cats, because you was holding down that residency.
Right.
So, yeah, he used to play at my high school when I was at Inglewood. So he never mixed on beat, though. That's why I liked your place, because he would just play records. It was like the radio. And I was just,
right,
you know, coming up and all of this. And then, you know, at the same time, Sugar Hill Gang comes out and, you know, Still Kids. And then Grandmaster Flash comes out with that record, man, The Wheels of Steel. The Adventures on the Wheels of Steel. And he's making these sounds, man. And I'm like, what is this? It's the record rocking back and forth. That's what got me sprung.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So where did you go to hone your techniques? Because as far as I'm aware, there was nobody out here actually doing that.
Yeah, there was.
How did you start learning to scratch?
Okay, so it was a trip. There was no physical representation of it. I never saw. It was no YouTube, as you're aware. This is for the younger generation. They can't even understand. I just had to explain to my daughter that you used to only be able to get music off the radio. She's just shocked with that. I tried to visualize what was happening because I couldn't really. I had only seen. That's why I was coming to the clubs and seeing what you guys are doing to see. You know,
I wasn't scratching
the motions. No, but I saw the motions. You know, you were cueing. You would cue your right.
Right.
And it's the same thing. But see, I had no concept of it at all. I had never seen a DJ do anything. I just heard that thing, and then I started seeing guys like you and Gene move the records, and so. It kind of came when I finally got, I didn't know anything about it. I got my dad to buy me turntables and a mixer, and I put that record on there. I figured out what the system was. You know, I did my little investigation. And when I did it, I said, this is what that is. It's just out loud. I was like, wow. And so I started practicing in my garage over on 6128, man, killing it. I used to have
how
kids
many
still
needles?
Watching,
how-
man.
How many needles did you break?
Oh.
DJ to DJ, how many needles did you break learning to do that?
You know, no one ever asked me that question, bro. And I'm going to tell you.
I'm a DJ just like you, my friend.
Yeah, and it's hilarious.
I tried it. See, I tried, but when I broke my first needle and the techniques I was using, that was it for me. I said, no, this is crazy. I'm going to stick to what
it's
I do.
Expensive. Man, look, them Stanton was too expensive, them cartridges.
Yeah.
680E.
They were expensive.
And whoa, but I broke about maybe 80 of them, bro. I used to, I'm going to tell you a secret, man. I never told nobody this. But when I used to be able to get into the clubs, I would steal them.
A needle?
I would take the needle right out the slot. DJ be looking for it.
Hey.
I did
it. It was serious.
Jackson.
I hear you.
I would slide them back
okay.
out. Like, yes, sir.
So you get your turntables, your sets, then what did you do? How did you start doing parties or what? Or did you hook up with some of the early crews? How did that process happen?
Well, I'll tell you what. When I first started, I had these SLB-1 turntables. Now, you remember belt-driven tables, you had to be gentle with those. So,
yes.
You know, extremely gentle. You had to develop a touch. So that's the beauty of it was, for what I was trying to do, there were no slip mats either. It was like, get the plastic in between the records. Remember that plastic sleeve? You used to hold it in plastic.
And you put it over there.
Put it over there. And so
yes, sir.
That developed a touch. And so you could develop, you know how to hit it without spinning it because you would hit it in the plastic, the record would brrr. You had to know how to. So I'm going to tell you, I developed that and I got the blessing of one crew. My boy, DJ Reg, a shout out to DJ Reg, he was DJing for a Capri Club at Chevy Hills Park. And he was a person who let me get on the turntables first in public. But I mean, I used to. Now, there was one person before I did with Julian Jackson. I went to the New York subway and I used to play up there, but nobody saw me.
Okay.
So, you know, Reg was the Capri Club. I didn't join the crew. I'm totally independent. That's why people talk about Uncle Jam's Army and all of them. I would go run through those crews and serve the DJs. And, you know, if y'all ain't better than me, I don't need to be in the crew.
Were you involved with the Radiotron?
Oh, well, that was. Now, there's this right there is a tricky question. Radio was the club.
Yo, there you go.
So I DJed at Radio. Radio was the groundbreaking place where all the hip-hop artists, the graffiti artists, dancers all developed their stuff in that place on Park View over there. Radio.
What year are we talking? What year are we talking now?
We talking 1983, early 83. Run DMC is just now popping, and, you know, it's it's now a few other rappers, you know, get Curtis Blow had hits and all of that now. And so, yeah, I'm playing over there now. Then the club radio created such a force in the city. There used to be a magazine in the L.A. Times called Calendar. I'm sure you know what I'm talking about. The Calendar used to be the biggest thing coming. Every Sunday, all entertainers was waiting on that to see what they got to write up or what was popping. And we had the cover. Right. They looked on there, and on the cover of the Calendar was Radio, the line of the club. And they're like, what the hell is this? This 1983.
Wow.
And so then all of a sudden we got a big boom over there, not just the eclectic stars mixed in with the 13-year-old breakdancers, but then Public started coming through and movie producers came through and they saw it and they came up with Breakin' and they called the club in the movie the Radiotron. And so that day we had agreed that Super AJ, KK, you know, me, Ice, all those cats, me and Ice was the talent, but those guys on the club, they decided to close. When the movie came out, they closed the club.
Wow.
Because they said that the legend, that was it. You got a movie.
Wow. Never
knew
that.
So then Radiotron popped up. They may have had something to do with it. Me and Ice was there opening night. I played there the first night, and I never went back. That became some other guys. I don't, you know, Antron and those cats, they, but see what they did. Now I'm going to call them out. Man, that's my point.
Go ahead. Do that. You can do that. You OG.
Yeah. There you go. We can do that. That's right. So, Trip, they rely on the legend of Radio to boost the Radiotron, because Radiotron wasn't even a year, man. It wasn't even around that long.
Right.
There was a bunch of kids from Santa Ana. It wasn't even the same, man. It was not. Sting didn't go there. Prince didn't go there. Michael Jackson didn't go there. Madonna didn't perform on stage with me and Ice-T there, you know? Radiotron is really just the movie, and anything that people say about Radiotron, it just kind of, I know how you feel. Let's just put it like that.
Righteous. Okay. Now, Ice-T, you mentioned him. How did you first meet him?
It was a funny thing. Radio. I come in. Actually, that's how I got my name to the club. We can jump to that. So I'm loading. I used to work for Audio Entertainment, which was you had to do both if you DJed. You had to have a source of equipment. So I used to work for the guy. So when I had gigs, I could have speakers and turntables and stuff, you know.
Was he called Ice-T at that time?
He was Ice-T. And he had a record I called Cold Wind Madness. He was the coldest rapper.
You know, I beat him in the rap contest, right, at the Carolina West in 81. You didn't know that at that time, though, because it wasn't a big thing.
No, I did know that. Let me tell you something. I knew that, and I'm going to tell you why we used to say you won that contest. You had a record. You know, you bad times is with them, and you rapped over that first.
No, that bad times, that was Captain Rap.
I know that was Captain Rap, but I remember hearing you rap over that instrumental. I swear I thought I did. But anyway.
The Rich Case and Rich Case Down. Yeah, Rich Case Down, the original. Right.
That's what it was.
Right, Rich Case Sounds was originally, and he died, and then Duffy. Right.
That one.
Right.
That's the funky beat right there, bro.
What year did you meet Ice? Was he calling himself Ice-T at that moment? When I rapped against him at the Carolina West, he was just calling himself Trey. This was August 1981.
Okay, go ahead, I'm sorry.
He won the first week. It was a two-week contest. He won the first week. But the club was so packed, and it was the first time KGFJ sponsored it, the first time the radio station and the nightclub saw that people will come out for this new music. That's what it was all about. Actually, it was an experiment by KGFJ. Ice beat me the first week, and I was a well-known DJ, and I was crushed. The next week I came back, they said, let's come back, let's do this next week, because the club owners loved it. Naturally, Carolina West was packed. So they came back the next week, I beat him, and that's when Duffy Hooks walked up out of the audience and offered me the recording contract. But he wasn't called Ice-T then. So when, right. So when you met him, he was Ice-T. He was calling himself Ice-T at that time.
Yeah, he had already lost to you because that's what made him, you know. I mean, the thing I thought about that, because I heard about that, and I was like, well, Carolina West, they older than us. Ice is older than me by 5 years. So Ice is, I think he's 5 years older than me. I'm pretty sure.
Okay.
He's pretty close to 60. So he, it was for me, I was young, and I was like, man, that's Carolina West. You know, my auntie and them go there. They older. You know what I mean, though, right?
You had to be 21 to get in there. Yeah, I remember.
And so 21 was like, whoa, they too old. They don't know about this. You know, Ice, you know, remember, my radio was from 13. But you can get in at 13 years old. They didn't sell alcohol. You could bring your own, you know?
Right.
And they didn't trip. It wasn't no fights. It wasn't nothing, man. It was always good.
Right.
But, see, we used to be in, I'll go to your spot, teen. I'm a teenager, and I'm hearing about Carolina West. We used to go try to catch the bus to walk by just to see it. Man,
right.
With the yellow brick road, remember that?
Oh, yeah. Yes, sir.
Yeah, baby. So, anyway, when I met him, I was delivering these speakers, actually, and this isn't when I met Ice, but I delivered the speakers. The club owner said, hey, I heard you're a DJ. What's your DJ name? I said, Chris. He was like, we're going to give you a name. When you come back, you come tonight, we'll see if you're any good. So I went, got my stuff, came with my one crate because I didn't carry no bunch of records, bro. I wasn't about that. I came in there, and Ice-T was on stage rapping, and my name was up there on a marquee above. It said The Glove, Chris The Glove.
Wow.
And I was like, okay, I'll take it.
That's how you got the name?
That's how I got my name. I first saw it in lights.
Wow. Never knew that either, Chris. Wow.
I thought
maybe you wore a glove or something like that to work with the turntables.
Well,
revelations,
no,
you got
me. Yeah, but check it out. They named me that because I wore these big, oversized gloves to move those Serwin Vegas because they were always smashing my fingers. So, and I'm a DJ, so you can't mess with my hands, right? I'm like overprotected.
Right.
And they used
Wow.
And so once I started DJing, and then I developed it, and I put the glove in right away. You know, that's it.
Right on.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
So Ice was, I met him in 80, the end of the beginning of 82. This all happened within a year, all of this stuff. It went from, I started in like 82-ish, the end of this, and 83 to end, we had already shot the movie. It wasn't even
Wow.
Mm-hmm.
Did you have any work to do? Did you do any work in the film? Itself,
I was in the film as myself, yeah, and I composed, I scored all the scenes in the club. I scored two.
Go ahead.
That was like, yeah, it was a trip because, you know, a little black boy up in there, you know, there wasn't too many of them doing that for them big movies.
Right. Right.
They were like, we need something authentic like this. They weren't calling it hip-hop. It was rap and something else they were calling it.
Right. Hip-hop wasn't
exactly. Hip-hop didn't come on for many years. So then they said, my girlfriend at the time was listening. She ear hustled. You know, I had a Jewish girlfriend, and she was like, yo, you need to go up over there.
Darlene Ortiz. I see his first girlfriend.
Darlene, yeah. She was, Darlene was, Lisa Maps was the one that was hanging around when I was there.
Oh, okay.
She's
not the one
Darlene.
On the album cover with the holding the shotgun, is she?
Nah, she's the second girlfriend. She's even the original. But, yeah, Darlene. That's my homegirl, too.
Okay.
Lisa's cool, too, but Darlene is great, man. Shout out to Darlene Ortiz with her book out there.
Yeah, she wrote a book. I haven't read it yet, though. So, Chris, you develop a relationship with Ice-T, and he gets a recording contract, and he gets some records out. And you end up working with him.
Well, okay, that's kind of not how it happened. This is what happened.
How did it happen?
At the same time, we're doing this movie, Back to the Ear Hustler, right?
Mm-hmm.
So remember,
mm-hmm.
Ice is in the movie. Nobody's thinking about a record. Everybody's being the movie. And so when the girl was like, my girl was like, go tell him you do the music. I was like, okay, I could get me a little more than this little $1,200 a week. I could go
mm-hmm.
get some money. So I went and told him. I had never wrote any music, but I told him I did. I had a drum machine. I knew that. And I got the score. I got the contract. And then after I did the score, they said, you know, we would like to have a rapper on it. Can you do take one of the pieces and make it into a rap? I was like, sure.
Mm.
So
mm.
picked up Ice-T in the middle of the night, or he met us and shot to the studio, and we put Rap Reckless on top of the score.
Wow. Wow.
Yeah, that was the score. That was not we made a record. We made the record after. So that was the only record I worked on with Ice-T. 4 million copies later, you know. So
okay.
I mean, you know.
And in fact, we could sort of say that was your first time actually doing producing or getting your fingers wet.
That was my first record I ever produced ever. Yeah, that was pretty much
the glove
the
Taylor.
First time I had been in the studio.
Wow. Okay.
I had to pay the guy to learn. Since I had been, the thing was, I had learned some things when I was recording. I hired an engineer, got the money, paid the studio. So
mm-hmm.
back up just a touch. While I was DJing, we used to do these bootlegs. I had a few of these vinyl bootlegs, like mixtapes, but on wax. And so I had these cats, Victor Flores, Carlos Mangalo. They would come with me. They hooked me up. They're from Pico Rivera out there with the Latin DJs. They used to DJ at Florentine Gardens and these big clubs, you know.
I remember on Hollywood Boulevard,
Yeah, and I was enthralled with that, like, wow. And so we started making stuff together, right? You know, I'm still only 19.
Uh-huh.
And so we making stuff together, and we making a few of them. We did a few of these mixers. He's famous. Victor's famous for the Michael Jackson mixer that came out years ago. He did this Michael Jackson amazing mix. It was really a mashup before the name mashup came up. So
right, okay.
I mean, he got world famous from that thing. So after that, that guy Victor is the one who introduced me to Dave Storrs, who co-produced all that stuff with me. He was the guy who knew how to do everything. Dave Storrs taught me how to be an engineer and how to produce. And you know what he did?
Wow.
I would ask him a question. I said, hey, man, what does this knob do? He said, turn it. Tell me what it did. Every time.
Wow.
That's how I learned. Yep.
That's the best way possible.
Man. And he taught me that. And then he gave me the freedom to turn it all the way up because people are scared to do that. They turn in increments and they inch their way around these engineers. They busters. You got to get in there and get that machine cooking. If you don't see no red lights, it ain't going to be no heat.
Mm. So you never went to school for engineering?
I went to school for aeronautical engineering, which is rocket.
Aeronautical engineering, but not being a DJ in the studio. But because you did go for aeronautical engineering, you sort of had a rudimentary knowledge of maybe electronics and stuff like that. It was easy probably to catch on.
Yeah, aeronautical engineering gives you a whole lot more than rudimentary. After I got into calculus in high school, I could understand a lot of stuff. And so like I told you, I had the record, but I couldn't visualize it. So I had to reverse engineer it. Like, you know, who does that?
Right.
So, yeah, I understood. It was, yeah, you're right. It was just the word engineering is the one that sticks. That's what I wanted to be. I wanted to get that. I understood it. I like music. Turn the knob. It's working. Oh, I like turning these knobs. I like sitting here all day. I could chill in this room all day. I like listening to that one part a million times. People can't do that.
Let's fast forward to Dr. Dre.
There's that name.
Yep, because we got about 10 minutes, and I want to get that part in because you were Dr. Dre's first DJ, weren't you?
Negative. I was Dr. Dre and I connected. I went through DJing some more. So after the movie break, and then I got into Paradise, which got me into the 1,500 and plus clubs. So I'm DJing these huge clubs. And now I'm actually breaking records. I'm a Billboard reporter. I'm a hot DJ. I'm really making it in the DJ world. Club owners and the record companies know me, and I'm doing remixes. And I'm starting to want to write music. So all this goes on, and I meet Dr. Dre. He's already got his success. He's like another one of those crews I ran through. He's a nemesis. You know, I got Egyptian Lover. He's a hot, he's the only, him and Bobcat. Bobcat actually was a kid who I helped put on myself. I put him on, you know, on the taste. He's hot. He's a badass DJ, but, you know, me and Egypt.
For those of you who don't know, not to interrupt you, Crips, but for those of you who don't know, Bobcat become one of the biggest producers in the business along with this man I'm talking to, Chris the Glove Taylor. Go ahead, Chris.
Oh, yeah. That guy got big records, bro. And that's another beautiful thing. It was like all of this talent. So I met Dre through the clubs. One of my buddies, Dave, introduced me to him and told him I did music. And he knew who I was because I was the only one who had a 4 million seller. None of them dudes were platinum. And see, I didn't.
You had a multi-platinum record. Yes, sir.
Yeah, they had a gold record, and they was like, what's that? I didn't even get gold. I don't even have gold. I went to platinum 4 million. I don't have no gold records. And you know you got to go gold to get platinum. We wouldn't buy it so fast, they didn't even bother. So I've never had a gold record, only platinum. So, and so with that Reckless, with 4 million copies, I mean, there was other records on there that helped push it, of course, in the movie and all that. It wasn't just us. We was just on there, basically, I feel, but 4 million is 4 million, buddy. What you got? That's what I was talking about. Like, what you got? So they went in, they did their persona and did the NWA, and he and I linked up on another level of production, and we just kind of clicked. I was signed to Ruthless. My group was signed to Ruthless, Poor Broken Lonely. I started producing with him, did a few things, and then I went with him to Death Row. You know, and
I never knew that
history. Yeah, we took over from there. I mean, everything we did was had to go platinum.
Let me ask you. What was your experience like in a couple of minutes we got left? I want you to talk about some of your current projects. But what was your experience like? We hear a lot about Death Row, Suge Knight. Was your experience positive or negative with the company? Without going into specifics.
Well, I can tell you this. My experience was positively negative. In other words, in the studio, fantastic. On the road, on stage, fantastic. But the antics of Death Row outside of that affect all of them. And I've never been hit or touched or I've witnessed some, you know, beat downs. The Lord has got me covered with his blood, but, you know. I couldn't understand why them cats was taking them. Like, you going to take that beat down? Man, I'm out of here. If I was, man, look.
Wow.
Yeah, so it was positively negative.
Okay. You come out of Death Row. Did you go with Dre when he started Aftermath? Any more work with him from that after that period?
Okay, so what I did was I left Death Row before all of them, before Tupac and everybody. Everybody think I'm crazy. Okay. Next thing you know, they all leaving. Tupac dead, you know? It's all bad. And so Dre started Aftermath, and I was doing some other stuff. I was working on something else, and he called me and said, you want to come, you know, Mike Lynn actually called me, one of my guys that's in the music business, and had me come over there, and I reconnected. We did some other records over there. I worked on a song that's been on the radio every day ever since it's been created, Phone Tap. He and I produced that.
Yes, sir.
And, know, from there went on to Explosive, which is on his 2001 record, which is another one that, actually, Kanye West claims that that's the record that got him back producing, and he sampled it over 6 times.
My record.
H to the Izzo. That's Glove.
Wow.
That's Glove's
yes, name. Sir. Yes, sir.
That's us.
Chris the Glove Taylor. What are you working on now? I know you're still very active in the business. Tell us about some of your upcoming projects and what you plan to do in the future.
Well, right now I have a project I'm working on called Letters from Cuba. It's going to be a short film about my television series I'm writing. So like an action series about a black family that does these things. I can't get into that. It's very, very positive. You'll love it. But the Letters is a soundtrack that I'm doing, and I have three of my new artists, Rocky Duh, Yui, and Via the Great. These are the artists that I'm pushing. Via the Great is a
are they rappers or singers? What do they do?
This is the thing, like, okay, so you know, like, Migos and those mumble rap guys? I got a singer that does something like that to those kind of tracks, but he sings. So you understand the words, and it's melodic.
Right.
You'll love it.
Right.
Trust me. And the others are rappers. So, you know, it's hip-hop. you know, it's us, it's me.
So we can look forward to some more work from Chris the Glove Taylor.
Well,
you also work with Egyptian Liver, right?
Oh, yeah. We did the radio crew together, man, me and Egypt.
Okay, the radio crew before Uncle Jam's Army, you worked with him then? Before he was with Uncle Jam's Army? Oh, okay.
Well, it's kind of all kind of concurrent. It's all together. Like, all that stuff happened at the same time. I didn't meet him before Uncle Jam's, but I met him, like, when he started. Like, once he popped up on the scene, I met him. And really, we were in different circles, and our circle finally coincided when we got to Crenshaw.
Okay.
Crenshaw Boulevard, we overlapped, and that was it.
My hood, we got to wind it up here. You're listening to Disco Daddy's Wide World of Hip Hop with one of the giants of hip hop. It's the Chris the Glove Taylor. Chris, I want to thank you for your time and for what you've contributed to hip hop, all right, worldwide. I have
thank
the greatest
you.
Respect for you, and I wish you nothing but the best, my brother. Hip hop love.
Man, respect to you, man. Hip hop love all day. Thank you, Michael Califani, Disco Daddy.
Thank you, my brother. You're listening to Disco Daddy's Wide World of Hip Hop. We want to thank you all for tuning in to our show. And stay tuned. We have some more guests coming your way.
So wasn't it a great show? Come back next week, every Saturday at 1 p.m. Pacific Time, 3 p.m. Central Time, 4 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. Disco Daddy's Wide World of Hip Hop Show. Man, it's a great one. Epic, epic. See you next week. Bye.
Thank you for keeping the flies.